Mormon society, with Mormon people, in and out of the church, because I love them. And I'm not going to hold my breath for the church to change.
Paper entitled Gays in the Church, Why It Can't Happen, by John Charles Duffy. A paper entitled Stumbling Blocks and Stepping Stones, the Inclusion of Gays, Lesbian, Bisexuals, Trans and Dual Gendered People in the LDS Plan of Salvation and Exaltation, by Duane Jeff Jennings.
Some people will dress up for their presentations and others won't. Since I wore shorts and t-shirts all the other days.
Hey, it's time for us to get started, so I'd like to ask you to take your seats if you could. My name's Rick Bickmore. I'll be chairing the session, which means I don't have to do much of the talking, thank goodness. We're going to be having a couple of papers presented, and afterward there will be time for questions. We'll be bringing a mic out to the audience. It doesn't reach everywhere, so if you're in the far edges, you may have to come to the mic. But we need to have questions asked on the mic for the tape recording of the session. Okay, the two papers that are being presented are, as you can see in your program, if I turn to the right page, I can see it too. The first paper will be by John Charles Duffy, entitled Gays in the Church, Why It Can't Happen. John Charles has received his BA in English at BYU and his MA in British and American Literature at the University of Utah. He works as an adjunct instructor teaching first-year writing at the U of U and Salt Lake Community College. His published articles include literary analyses of gay-related themes in works of Oscar Wilde and William D. Howells. He has written Understanding and Helping Those Who Feel Homosexual Attraction, Suggestions for LDS Family and Friends, for the Gay Mormon Organization Affirmation, of which he's a member, and has just finished a new booklet, Enlightened by the Spirit of Truth, A Guide for Same-Sex Attracted Latter-day Saints. He also writes a monthly column in the Pillar, one of Salt Lake City's gay newspapers, and he lives in Salt Lake with his partner, who admires him very much, even when they don't agree sometimes. And the second paper will be entitled Stumbling Blocks and Stepping Stones, the Inclusion of Gays, Lesbians, Bisexuals, Trans and Dual-Gendered Peoples in the LDS Plan of Salvation and Exaltation. That's being presented by Duane Jennings. Duane is a sixth-generation Mormon, raised in Salt Lake City, and graduated from the University of Utah with a bachelor's degree in English and a minor in history, and a secondary school teaching certificate. He has published quite a few articles in gay and lesbian publications, especially gay Mormon publications. He led the local chapter of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons for several years, and has also served in its international leadership. In fact, he's done that for several years. He is currently doing that now. Last year, he served a term as the senior assistant director, if I can get that right. In 1997, he also received both the Utah Man of the Year Award from the Pillar, the local, one of the major local gay publications, and also the Mortensen Award from Affirmation. That's Affirmation's highest award for service. So we've got there. Both of these gentlemen have quite a few other qualifications. We could spend a lot of time on their qualifications, but instead we'll go ahead and move right into John Charles's presentation, after which Duane will make his presentation, and then we'll take the questions.
All righty. The Church's position on homosexuality has three dimensions. One, homosexual behavior is a serious sin, though behavior needs to be distinguished from feelings or susceptibilities. Two, homosexual behavior can and should be overcome through repentance and gospel living, with professional assistance if necessary. Three, any attempt to undermine the traditional family poses a threat to the fabric of society, hence the Church's very well-financed opposition to movements such as the Campaign for Same-Sex Marriage. Within Mormonism, groups have sprung up which challenge this position. Such groups aim to educate Latter-day Saints about homosexuality in the interest of fostering gay-friendly attitudes within the Church. Educate and gay-friendly are in quotes. In other words, they aim to persuade Church members, one, that homosexual behavior per se is no more sinful than heterosexual behavior per se, two, that homosexuality is an immutable, probably inborn condition, which therefore cannot be overcome by therapy or any other means, and three, that the gay rights movement represents a bona fide demand for civil rights by a discriminated against minority. These efforts to educate members about homosexuality are based on the assumption that the Church's position can and will eventually change. This in turn seems to assume that the Church's opposition to homosexuality grows out of prejudice, intolerance, homophobia, bigotry, ignorance, or misunderstanding. Gay-friendly Mormons therefore make frequent appeals to tolerance, love, compassion, and the injunction to judge not, publicize scientific findings which suggest homosexuality is a normal condition, or offer new interpretations of scriptural passages which seem to condemn homosexual behavior. These are all strategies which have produced substantial gains for gay and lesbian people within other religious denominations and within society at large. However successful these strategies have been elsewhere, they will not succeed at bringing gays and lesbians into full fellowship in the LDS Church. This is because LDS opposition to homosexuality does not simply stem from homophobia, intolerance, ignorance, and so on. Rather, the Church's position on homosexuality is the logical extension of fundamental LDS teachings about the nature of God. This is not to say that homophobia does not exist within the LDS Church, nor is it to say that appeals to tolerance, love, compassion, and so on can't produce positive change in members' attitudes towards gay and lesbian people. But it is to say that reducing the Church's position to homophobia overlooks a deep-rooted doctrinal problem that would need to be overcome before gays and lesbians could achieve full fellowship in the Church. On to the doctrinal problem. Ever since the last years of Joseph Smith's life, LDS teaching has been that God is an exalted man, the literal father of our spirits. As God's children, we have as the object of our existence to become like him, that is, to become gods, exalted beings with glorified bodies like his, capable of procreation, a continuation of the seeds forever and ever, as D&C 132 verse 19 puts it. This idea is the foundation of everything we teach about the plan of salvation, temple marriage, and eternal families. Over the years, Latter-day Saints have become euphemistic about this conception of God and tend to back away when confronted with it by outsiders, as we've seen President Hinckley do recently in the media, for instance. Yet the doctrine continues to be taught, however cautiously, as the first principle of the first missionary discussion. And the proclamation on the family alludes to the doctrine when it says that each person is a beloved spirit, son, or daughter of heavenly parents, and as such has a divine nature and destiny. If it is true that our divine destiny is to have a continuation of the seeds forever and ever through temple marriage between a man and his wife, which are the terms used in D&C 132, it's easy to see why the Church has serious problems with homosexuality. God, in the LDS tradition, is a heterosexual. In fact, his heterosexuality is one of the defining traits of his divinity. Hence, D&C 132 insists that heterosexual marriage, sealed by the appropriate authority, is the only way to become a god. If a man marry a wife by my law and by the new and everlasting covenant, it shall be of full force when they are out of the world. Then shall they be gods. and except ye abide by this law, ye cannot attain to this glory. Because of this doctrine, the church cannot accept the idea that some people are immutably homosexual, because such people would be disqualified for exaltation. This is what James E. Faust means when he says that if homosexuality were genetically inherited, this would, quote, frustrate the whole plan of mortal happiness, end quote. Faust is saying that if people were born homosexual, that is to say, unable to function in a heterosexual marriage, they would be unable to comply with the requirements for exaltation, ergo, to attain lasting happiness in this world and the world to come. It is therefore unthinkable to Faust that God would allow people to be born with such a handicap. Given the doctrinal base from which he starts, Faust knows, a priori, that scientific evidence indicating that homosexuality is inborn and immutable cannot really mean what it seems to mean. And no amount of literature from Dean Hamer or the APA is going to convince him otherwise. Please note that this is not bigotry on Faust's part or ignorance. It is a perfectly logical conclusion given the premises from which he begins. If we disapprove of Faust's dismissal of the scientific evidence, that's because we place more faith in science than he does. The church has a long history of dissenting from mainstream science on issues ranging from organic evolution to the authorship of Genesis to the origin of the Maya. Scientific arguments against its position on homosexuality will move the church not in the slightest. Similarly, because LDS opposition to homosexuality grows out of a uniquely LDS conception of God, the kinds of scriptural reinterpretations that have brought gays and lesbians into fuller fellowship in other denominations will not work in the LDS church. I'm going to burp, but it's not happening yet. For other denominations, this issue boils down to debates over how to interpret biblical injunctions against homosexual behavior, texts like Leviticus 18:22 or Romans 1:27. Those debates have no relevance to the LDS position on homosexuality, because the LDS position does not rest on those biblical passages. It rests on D&C 132. Even if the church were to do a huge about-face, rejecting the notion that homosexual behavior per se is sinful, that would still not eliminate the core doctrinal problem. The position of gay couples in the church would then become analogous to that of people who marry outside the temple. Marrying outside the temple is not a sin, but it does disqualify you from exaltation if the marriage is never sealed. By the same token, even if the church did not believe that gay couples are necessarily living in sin, the doctrine that a man needs to marry a wife by the new and everlasting covenant in order to qualify for godhood would still compel the church to conclude that gay couples do not qualify for exaltation. At this point, it may seem that the obvious solution to this problem is for the church to start marrying and sealing gay couples. But the documents the church accepts as scripture provide no justification for that course of action. What we would need, therefore, is a new revelation, an official declaration 3, if you will. A lot of gay-friendly Mormons I know have no problem imagining the appearance of such a revelation. It's not uncommon to hear people compare the debate over homosexuality to the controversy over polygamy, the subject of official declaration 1, or to compare the status of homosexuals in the church to the status of blacks before 1978 when official declaration 2 was adopted. But a change in the church's position on homosexuality would require a much greater change in the LDS worldview overall, there's the verb, than either official declarations 1 or 2 did, which makes the likelihood of such a revelation very slim. Official declaration 1 compelled the church to repudiate the notion that plural marriage is a prerequisite for exaltation, but it did not change the fundamental notion that to be a god means to be sealed in an eternal heterosexual marriage. Official Declaration 2 was even easier for the church to incorporate from a doctrinal standpoint because the tradition of denying blacks the priesthood was based on non-canonical statements by early leaders, and the saints had always believed that blacks would receive the priesthood at some point. Most importantly, Official Declaration 2 did not challenge the fundamental teachings about the nature of God. By contrast, an Official Declaration 3 bringing gays into full fellowship, including same-sex sealings, would change LDS doctrine at a fundamental level. Indeed, a revelation of that nature would be as earth-shaking as Joseph Smith's declaration that God is an exalted man, because a revelation of that nature would force the church to espouse a belief in homosexual gods. I can just imagine Godmakers 3. And it would almost certainly require the church to repudiate the idea that to be a god is to have eternal progeny, which in turn would mean dancing complicated circles around DNC 132, which explicitly states this. Alternatively, the church could go the route of the reorganized LDS church and embrace a more traditionally Christian conception of God in the afterlife, thus eliminating the core doctrinal problem. But that seems even less likely, given what we've been teaching for the past 150 years about the apostasy, plus we'd have to dance even bigger circles around DNC 132. To complicate matters further, an official Declaration 3 would have a ripple effect in various areas of church practice, beginning with temple worship. Currently, temple rites are structured on the assumption that a marriage consists of a man and a woman, and that they are not on equal footing. Introduce same-sex couples into the picture, and you raise some thorny questions. Which homosexual partner will covenant to hearken to the counsel of the other? Which partner will bring which through the veil? Which partner will have the privilege of learning the other's new name? Which partner will be the one who covenants not only to take the other, but also to be given to the other in marriage? In the current sealing ceremony, the woman both takes the man to be her husband and gives herself to him as his wife. The man takes the woman as his wife, but does not give himself to her, presumably so he's free to take on plural wives. Obviously, gay couples would sort of complicate this whole dynamic. Then there's the problem of the all-male priesthood. Part of the logic of confining the priesthood to men is that the priesthood serves as the authority by which fathers preside over their families. If both father and mother were priesthood holders, it would become less clear who had the right to preside. But you would have precisely this situation in the case of a gay male couple where both are priesthood holders. And in the case of a lesbian couple, there would be no one to, quote-unquote, preside over the family. Same-sex sealings would thus compel the church to rethink its ideas about who should be ordained to the priesthood and who has the right to preside in the family. Now, for those of us who have complaints about the status of women in the church, everything I've just said probably makes the idea of same-sex sealings sound all the more appealing, and that fact is not lost on the brethren. That's why one of the points they've taken to highlighting over and over lately is that gender is an eternal characteristic. Whenever this point comes up in connection with homosexuality, gay-friendly Mormons retort that gender identity is not synonymous with sexual orientation. While that may well be true, the two are nevertheless linked as far as LDS teaching is concerned, because the church's opposition to homosexuality goes hand in hand with the conviction that men and women fill distinct, complementary, non-interchangeable roles, both in this world and the next. In order to sanction homosexual partnerships, the church would have to stop teaching that gender difference matters. And that would logically demand that the church at least contemplate a wholesale reorganization of its priesthood and auxiliary organizations and youth groups, along with a major revision of its teachings on the proper roles of family members and appropriate styles of dress for missionaries and temple goers, and the lengths of time for which missionaries can serve, and the age at which they can serve, and the propriety of women working outside the home, all of which currently proceed from a system of segregation on the basis of gender. And there's the rub. A new revelation bringing gays into full fellowship would have so many ramifications in so many other areas of church teaching and practice that I have no hope of seeing it happen within my lifetime. If the church isn't ready even to make husbands give themselves to their wives in the same way that wives give themselves to their husbands, it's nowhere close to entertaining the possibility of a husband giving himself to a husband or a wife to a wife with all that that would entail. This will remain true as long as the church's opposition to homosexuality is a socially respectable and politically viable stance. History indicates that new revelation comes only when the church faces so much opposition that the brethren are compelled to prayerfully reconsider their course. Official Declaration 1 didn't come about until the federal government threatened to confiscate the temples. Official Declaration 2 didn't come until after protesters were hurling Molotov cocktails at BYU athletes. We're not to that point yet on the gay issue. The church's position on homosexuality is still shared by large segments of American society. And though the tide of public sentiment is beginning to change, it will be a long time before the church faces the kind of intense, overwhelming opposition that has prompted the search for new revelation in the past. And considering how fundamental the doctrines involved are, it's possible an official Declaration 3 will never come on this subject, no matter how much criticism the church receives. This is depressing. If you're a gay or lesbian person who has no intention of remaining celibate all your life, or also wants full fellowship in the LDS church, I can't offer you hope that that will happen within your lifetime. What you want is simply incompatible with fundamental LDS teaching. That's not to say that you personally can't live in the hope that there's more to the plan of salvation than we know. There's an intriguing statement in the 1916 doctrinal exposition by the First Presidency and the 12 on the Father and the Son. Say that 10 times quickly. There's a statement in that document which explicitly raises the possibility that there may be more to the plan of salvation than we know. The document says, this is a passing statement, it says that, quote, so far as the stages of eternal progression and attainment have been made known through divine revelation, end quote, we are to understand that being an exalted being is to bring forth eternal progeny. If you're looking for an out for yourself, that's as good a one as you're likely to find in the corpus of LDS teaching. But it's not much, and it's nothing I would expect the current authorities to act on. Great strides have been made towards convincing the church to soften its anti-homosexuality rhetoric, and I suspect that trend will continue. Given time, members are likely to become more comfortable with the idea of out but celibate gay people in their midst. Members might be persuaded to stop quoting biblical proof texts against homosexuality, though given a tradition of LDS skepticism with regards to modern biblical scholarship, I doubt it. The church might stop supporting anti-gay rights campaigns if it could be persuaded that such support damages its public image, but that's a long shot. It might be persuaded to abandon research into reparative-type therapies for the same reason, but that's also a long shot. But as long as Latter-day Saints worship and aspire to become like a heterosexual God, the most gays and lesbians can hope for, the absolute most, is second-class citizenship in the kingdom. And that, too, is a really long shot.
Okay, we'll see where we go. I wished I was shorter. I can read better. Well, that's what I was thinking, but...
He was thinking of that, but then I said, I've been in sessions where people told them to stand up.
All right. The scriptures have been misused to support slavery, segregation, apartheid, to sanction the physical emotional abuse of women, persecute Jews and non-Christian people of faith, to oppose medical science, to condemn interracial marriage, to execute women as witches, and to condone intolerance and discrimination against sexual minorities. The term sexual minority includes gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and intersex, hermaphrodite, peoples, henceforth referred to as GLTB. Sounds clumsy, but GLBT. Sexuality means much more than arousal and orgasm. Sexuality is part and parcel of the human capacity to love, for we are not just intellectual beings, we are emotional and physical too. To have to be afraid to feel sexual is to restrain the noblest of human possibilities, love. It is to short-circuit human spontaneity and a whole array of expressions, creativity, motivation, passion, commitment, heroic achievement. For people to have to choose between religion and sexuality is to have to choose between religion and themselves. As we are coming to understand the matter today, it is to have to choose between God and human wholeness. The issue of homosexuality and gender threaten to fracture whole denominations as slavery did 150 years ago. So what are the stumbling blocks? John Charles has named quite a few of them. As I see it, they include biblical scriptures, the concept of Adam and Eve, heavenly parents who procreate spirit children, the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, and statements by modern church leaders. Only six scriptures coming from the Old and New Testament appear to be problematic. I will address these briefly. I don't want this to be a paper regarding biblical error. The story of Lot's family and Sodom and Gomorrah is found in Genesis 19. The scriptures themselves never define the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah to be homosexual behavior. Ezekiel 16 says that the sin was living in pride, plenty, thoughtless ease, and they ignored the poor and needy and committed abomination. This phrase confuses a lot of people, who have been taught that homosexuality is an abomination. Many assume that the Bible clearly condemns all such acts. This deduction is incorrect. Here the Hebrew word tewibo, which means idolatrous acts, practices involved in pagan worship. Isaiah 13 condemns Sodom for its injustice, while Jeremiah 23:14, 49:18, and 50:40 define the sin as moral laxity, not specifically sex. The Book of Wisdom in the Apocrypha describes the sin as unwillingness to receive strangers or inhospitality to those in need. In Luke 9:51-56, Jesus refused to call down the fire on a Samaritan town at the request of James and John, who wanted punished as was Sodom. What was the great sin of the Samaritan town? It was the refusal to show hospitality to Jesus and the disciples. In Luke 10:8-12, Jesus makes explicit this parallel between the inhospitality of Sodom and the inhospitality of those who would reject him and his messengers. The LDS biblical theologian and BYU professor Emeritus Hugh Nibley has written, "A favorite trick is to put the whole blame on sex. Sex can be a pernicious appetite, but it runs a poor second to the other. For example, we are wont to think of Sodom as the original sex pot, but according to all the accounts, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, that great wealth made her people cruel and self-righteous. The worst sinners, according to Jesus, are not the harlots and publicans, but the righteous leaders with their insistence on proper dress and grooming, their careful observance of the rules, their pernicious concern for status symbol, their strict legality, their pious patriotism." In 1843, the prophet Joseph Smith preached in the Nauvoo Temple that God destroyed Sodom for rejecting the prophets. In Judges chapter 19 and 20 is a parallel story that takes place in the town of Gibeah, where the concubine of a Levite is gang-raped. The army of Israel destroys Gibeah, plus 18,000 men of the tribe of Benjamin, fellow Israelites. In ancient Jewish tradition, the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah and Gibeah of inhospitality. In Christianity, the argument against homosexuality may be traced directly to the letters of the medieval church fathers, including its linkage with Sodom and Gomorrah. The church during the 13th century crusades to the Holy Land used racism and religious bigotry to win support, financial, and able bodies. Church letters in Rome laid many accusations against Muslims, equating Muslim behavior to Sodom and Gomorrah and scaring European men and boys with the fear of rape. The church leaders shifted the interpretation of a couple of scriptures, and all same-sex acts were condemned. It is during this time the term sodomy was created to refer to homosexual activity. In the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, this time period is referred to as the Great Apostasy. There are only two other Old Testament scriptures that appear to be problematic. These are part of the Law of Moses found in Leviticus chapter 18:22, and that reads, "Thou shalt not lie with man as thou with womankind. It is abomination." And Leviticus 20:13 reads, "If a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them." The laws from this section of Leviticus were directed at the Levites, the priests who were intended to ensure the cultural survival of Israel by drawing boundaries between them and the people of the land. Thus, the Hebrews were forbidden from taking part in the local fertility cult worship to Moloch, the fire god of the Ammonites. These fertility ceremonies included temple prostitutes of both genders, intercourse between family members, and the sacrifice of children. The priestly codes also declared which foods were allowed or prohibited, which crops could be sown in the same field, which relatives were able to marry, and which fibers could be mixed for making clothing. All were called abomination or ritually unclean. Nowhere in Leviticus is homogenital activity outside a pagan ritual called unethical or immoral. Nowhere does it call homosexuality immoral as it does adultery. It is interesting to note that in the current LDS edition of the Bible, the word sodomite in Deuteronomy 23:17 is footnoted, Hebrew, a professional male or female prostitute or cultist. Nevertheless, despite the important clarification, the footnote then refers the reader to homosexuality in the topical guide. An important point, nowhere in the Old Testament are homosexual acts between women condemned or even mentioned. Still, isn't this enough to condemn homosexuality? No, not unless we accept the Law of Moses as still binding. The fulfillment of the law of Moses is part of Mormon theology, as found in 3 Nephi 9, verse 17. Whether gay or straight, transgender or intersex, if one has taken upon oneself Christ's name, they are not involved in idolatry. The rest of the biblical verses have been ignorantly or maliciously translated. The verses refer either to sexual abuse or to pagan temple prostitutes who came in both genders and were both homosexual and heterosexual. Three books I would encourage people to read, so you can maybe argue, I don't know, are what the Bible really says about homosexuality, homosexuals in biblical times, and same-sex unions in pre-modern Europe. And I have a bibliography that I'll be handing out at the end with books and websites. I've cut so much. Stepping stones. Maybe how we can overcome some of the attitudes. When a scientific theory conflicts with the teaching of Christ, how does one decide whether it's the case of science having failed to take into account spiritual truths or a case of the saints having mistaken an incorrect tradition of the fathers for divine revelation? By looking at science and the human experience and by re-examining the scriptures in an attitude of openness to the Spirit, I believe a new understanding is possible, based on a greater insight into God's creation and the gospel of Jesus Christ. In May of 1874, Brigham Young said in the Salt Lake Tabernacle, "There is no true religion without true science, and consequently there is no true science without true religion." The stepping stones. Psychology. Is sexual orientation a choice? In a recent medical journal, the American Psychiatric Association writes, in answer to this question, "No, sexual orientation emerges for most people in early adolescence without any prior sexual experience. Some people report trying very hard over many years to change the sexual orientation from homosexual to heterosexual with no success. For these reasons, psychologists do not consider sexual orientation for most people to be a conscious choice that can be voluntarily changed." The October 94 New England Journal of Medicine states the origins of sexual orientation to be appear to be multifactorial and diverse. Preliminary evidence suggests biological factors as well as prenatal sex hormones. Some prenatal hormonal events may be under genetic influence, whereas others may occur as a result of environmental factors. For example, in prenatal stress, which inhibits the action of testosterone, influences the sexual behavior of experimental animals and may influence sexual orientation in humans. This type of research, for example, on rats, has been conducted at many institutions, including BYU. Using hormonal injections during pregnancy, scientists have been able to produce only homosexually oriented rats, for example. But once established, as they might, scientists at BYU as well, have not been able to reverse the orientation they have created by any known drugs, hormones, or combinations. One of the best books to start with on the topic of science is The Science of Desire, The Search for the Gay Gene by Dean Hamer that John Charles mentioned. Biology. In the animal kingdom is found a great diversity in gender, male, female, intersex, and asexual. A couple of animal species can even physically change sex in order to procreate. Also, we find heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual expression in couplings, including lifelong monogamous homosexual couplings in a few species. And another good book, which is on the list, just came out this year, and I won't go over the title. The realities of the animal kingdom, the various ways that animals procreate, suggest that the model of male and female is only part of a bigger picture, only part of the story of creation. The human experience mirrors the diversity that is found in nature. Hermaphrodites, or intersex, is a diverse category of individuals that varies widely from the Victorian or 1950s Ozzie and Harriet concept of male and female. Beginning in the 1950s, a standard medical practice for treating these children of God has been to assign them a gender and quickly perform the surgery to make their genitals match the norm. In the book Ponyfish Glow and Other Clues to Plan and Purpose in Nature, the researcher George Williams discusses the biological occurrence in which a person is born with two sets of DNA, double male, double female, or male and female. The American Academy of Pediatricians admits that on average, 5 intersex infants are altered every day in America to make their genitals cosmetically normal. BYU professor of zoology Dwayne Jeffrey has examined the problem of intersex development in humans, and his article can be found in Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon Thought, autumn 1979. The total number of intersex people is well over 2% of the population, and there are over 80 or more syndromes that have been found that cause this, these variations. A short list of theological questions can be rightly asked in regards to this frequent variation. They are, one, what gender are these individuals in relation to male and female? Two, what gender were they in the preexistence if gender is eternal? Three, what gender will these intersex children of God be in the resurrection? Four, are they worthy to receive the priesthood since many of them have a testicle and a penis, as well as an ovary and a vagina? Five, are intersex persons worthy and able to have a companion with whom to share life? No matter what gender one of these children of God picks as a companion, the relationship is both heterosexual and homosexual for the intersex person and bisexual for the single-gendered companion. Six, even if an intersex person has an operation, what gender are they really in the spirit? Seven, if an intersex person is operated on and made, say, a boy, raised as a boy and given the priesthood, but in adolescence feels that he is a girl and attracted to boys, is this child of God homosexual? Has he, she committed sin? Does she still have the priesthood? Eight, does it really matter? Genesis 1:27 reads, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he them. Male and female created he them." Based on what is written in the Bible, one could interpret what could interpret this passage as God being both male and female. In the Old Testament, both the words Yahweh and Yahweh are used. Yahweh is masculine and Yahweh is feminine. I'll let people's minds think on that if Jehovah is Jesus Christ, as taught in the church. Homosexuality. 2% to 14% is the estimated frequency of exclusive sexual same-sex attraction depending on which study one wants to look at. However, most researchers believe the actual number to be between 3.5 and 7%. Science has proven that hormones secreted at a specific time during gestation will create homosexual orientation in mammals. What triggers the hormones naturally is not known for certain, though some patterns have been observed. All indicators suggest that it's the same in humans or similar. A good overview of the research from a Mormon perspective can be found in Sin and Sexuality, Psychobiology, and the Development of Homosexuality by Jan Stout that can be found in Dialogue, Summer 87, and Chapter 22 in Peculiar People. Sterility. Between 16 and 17% of heterosexual couples can't conceive. Broken down, at least 8% of all heterosexual married humans, male and female, cannot produce the life-creating cells known as sperm and egg. An often stated cliche is God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve or Adam and Eve. The use of Genesis against gays and lesbians shows a huge lack of understanding, the understanding of God's creation. Concluding this point, intersex make up 2% plus. Homosexuality, 6%, sterility, 8%, minus the 2% most of the intersex group, but not all. Heterosexuality is less than 80% of the 6% of the population. Lesbian, gay, transgendered, and intersex children of God ask different questions and have different needs. Individuals, families, and the church must work out the corresponding theological and spiritual implications. The Bible to the rescue, or the scriptures, I guess. In the Jewish Talmud, a eunuch is not necessarily a castrated male, but a male who is not going to reproduce for various reasons. Isaiah 56 reads, "Neither let the eunuch say, 'Behold, I'm a dry tree,' for thus saith the Lord unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths and choose the things that please me and take hold of my covenant. Even unto them will I give in mine house and within my walls a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. The Lord God, which gathereth the outcast of Israel, saith, Yet will I gather others to him besides those that are gathered unto him." In God's house, the achievement of each individual soul has a count. The central metaphor for Israel is still family, but Israel and later tradition open up another avenue. After receiving a vision regarding the availability of the gospel to Gentiles, people of color, and eunuchs, the Apostle Paul said in Acts 10:34, and 5. Of a truth I perceive that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted with him. Biblical scholars who study sexuality and social customs believe the term eunuchs referred to sterile, homosexual, and castrated individuals, and perhaps intersex, since most cannot reproduce. When Christ was ministering around Jerusalem, he taught regarding marriage. All cannot receive this saying. It is not for them, save they to whom it is given. For there are some eunuchs which were so born from their mother's womb. There are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs for men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive, let him receive my saying. The commandment of God's children, for God's children to multiply and replenish the earth is in force for those who are capable physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Isaiah's promise comes into play for the rest of the human family, as well as Christ's statement to his disciples found in Matthew 19. Are there other clues in the Bible? Gays and lesbians of the Old Testament. I'll just do two quick. The centurion story that can be found in Luke 7, 2 through 7, it is recorded in Matthew 8 as well. The centurion is a Roman soldier who has converted to the Jewish faith. The centurion goes in person to Christ regarding his slave that is sick. The Greek word used for the centurion and slave is pious. This is a type of male slave who is usually used for sex. An important point is that the servant is dear to the centurion. Christ does not condemn the centurion's lifestyle. Instead, Christ heals the slave and then turns to his disciples and says in Luke 7, 9, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. The other example is the sexual relationship between King David and Jonathan. The sexual relationship between King David and Jonathan, the son of King Saul, is fairly clear. In 2 Samuel 1, 26, David says, my brother Jonathan, very pleasant hast thou been to me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Earlier in 1 Samuel 20, Saul accused the two men of knowing each other, as Saul had known Jonathan's mother. David and Jonathan made a covenant together and with God. In doing so, they employed the same Hebrew word used for the marriage covenant elsewhere in the Bible. The prophet Samuel records that God blessed them. There are several other possible references in both the Old and New Testament, including Ruth and Naomi, Daniel, Narcissus, and several dozen eunuchs. How about the New World, the Book of Mormon? In Alma 53:2 is the story of Moroni and Lehi. This verse reads, now behold, this Lehi was a man who had been with Moroni in the more part of all his battles. And he was a man like unto Moroni, and they rejoiced in each other's safety. Yea, they were beloved by each other. Which meaning of beloved is being used? The assumption that it is sexless, only together without mercy. The great parent of the universe looks upon the whole of the human. Looking at the pre-Columbian archaeology of sample evidence of homosexual behavior depicted in the pottery and murals that date between 600 BC and AD 400, the time of the Book of Mormon that the Book of Mormon covers. This is especially true among the Mayan and Mochican nations. And acquaintances related to me that in the National Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology in Peru, candy found pottery depicting the Roman presented in depth in John Boswell's Same-Sex Union Pre-Modern Europe. And goes over, anyway, I would suggest that. Reviewing the scriptures, homosexuality remains an open question. Still, the real possibility of homosexual relationships in the lives of important historical biblical and Book of Mormon individuals suggests that the scriptures may be more open, not according to the narrow contracted notions of men. The restored gospel is a call to forsake the judgmental attitudes and misguided beliefs of tradition. The church must continue to overcome the prejudicial beliefs in all cultures around the world from which the church and its members come out from. Joseph Smith further taught, that which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another. God said, thou shalt not kill. At another time he said, thou shalt utterly destroy. This is the principle upon which the government of heaven is conducted, by revelation adapted to the circumstance in which the children of the kingdom are placed. If we seek first the kingdom of God, all things will be added, even things which might be considered abominable to all who understand the order of heaven only in part, but which in reality are right. Our Heavenly Father is more liberal in his views and boundless in his mercies and blessings than we are ready to believe or receive. Elder William C. Dunbar remarked in 1874 in Salt Lake, "People consider that science and religion are opposed to each other. True science and true religion are not opposed to each other. False religion and true science are opposed to each other. As men become acquainted with the laws of nature, which are the laws of God, they are compelled to lay aside false religion, and consequently they say religion is all nonsense. But if he were in possession of true religion, he would not have to throw it away. Neither would he have to abandon his science because they do not harmonize." Dallin Oaks, a century later, said, "Different persons have different physical characteristics," talking about homosexuality here, "and different susceptibilities to the various physical emotional pressures we may encounter in our childhood and adult environments. We do not choose these personal susceptibilities either, but we do choose and will be accountable for the attitudes, priorities, behavior, and lifestyle we engraft upon them." Amen, Brother Oaks. "I have met hundreds of gay and lesbian Mormons and other Christians who have toiled with the Spirit to know God's will regarding them. They have shared their stories. After exerting much faith, effort, faith, and patience, they have been rewarded with confirmation by the Spirit, by dreams or personal revelation, that they are as God has created them, whole and complete and worthy of the same of a same-gender companion. A friend who, after several years of struggle and prayer, had a dream of the pre-existence. He related to me, 'I was seated before a council. The person closest to me presented a series of different challenges that I would be faced during my earthly journey. Each time a challenge was presented, I knew I could accept or decline, knowing another challenge would be given. I was given a number of challenges, accepting each with the phrase, 'That is not big enough, a big enough challenge.' The last challenge presented was to be a homosexual. He explained that many people wouldn't approve, that the challenge would be to deal with the hatred and judgment of others. To this I replied, 'That is a big enough challenge. Here am I, send me.' At this point, the door opened, behind me opened, and the Savior Jesus Christ entered. He addressed the council and said, 'Because of his, my friend's valiancy in the war in heaven, he must be born into a family where he will be taught the gospel and he must hold the priesthood.' Then the dream closed. I woke in tears. The Spirit was strong in my room, testifying to me that the dream was of God. My own answer came from God after several years of searching with a broken spirit. I finally received understanding and confirmation. I am as I am, and that is good, and it is a choice, and it is the choices that I make within my orientation that make it either good or bad. Since my acceptance, I have been in an accelerated learning process in life and in the gospel of Jesus Christ." In the temple ceremony, there is a phrase that leaves room for new understanding, a new understanding, acceptance of God's children into the scheme of things. That phrase is, "This, however, is figurative so far as the man and the woman are concerned." The temple ceremony and this phrase echoed over and over in my mind and became one of the keys to my eventual reconciliation with God as I started dealing with my own orientation and turmoil. In 1990, this phrase was deleted from the ceremony. Inspired? Maybe. And maybe not. Through the restoration, we had the teaching of heavenly parents, a father and mother in heaven. Tied to this teaching is the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. Immediately after the organization of the church, Joseph Smith declared that baptism is a new and everlasting covenant, even that which was from the beginning. Joseph Smith frequently referred to the restored gospel as the new and everlasting covenant, and the priesthood and baptism for the dead were also referred to as such. It wasn't until 1876 that Section 131 and 132 were printed in the Doctrine and Covenants. Polygamy had been an official teaching for almost 25 years. Section 131 was compiled from three different sources, two sermons and one verse, and verses 1 through 4 directed to William Clayton on the evening of May 16, 1843. What was said to William Clayton reads, "In the celestial glory, there are three heavens or degrees, and in order to obtain the highest, a man must enter into this order of the priesthood, and if he does not, he cannot obtain it. He may enter into the other, but this is the end of his kingdom. He cannot have an increase." What part of the new and everlasting covenant is being referred to? In the original printing, the phrase meaning the new and everlasting covenant of marriage was not part of Joseph's statement to William Clayton, at least that which I have found so far, and if anyone has a place where I can go and find more information. It does appear in the 1876 DNC. So, an increase of what? Priesthood power to create worlds and universe. Today, the accepted definition of increase is based on the understanding of how people procreate on earth. However, we do not know how spirits are created. If gender is eternal, then there have to be eternal intersex resurrected beings, or perhaps in the resurrection we are all male and female, as it states in Genesis 1:27, and all capable of having spirit children. Let's move to section 132. It is similar in that it was compiled from a couple of different sermons. In this section, the doctrine of the three degrees of glory is elaborated on. The highest is divided into three subdivisions. This section does set forth marriage, or at least the ceiling is perhaps the pinnacle of the new and everlasting covenant. But more will be said on this point in a minute. Eliza R. Snow wrote the beloved Mormon hymn, O My Father, that contains the couplet, In the heavens are parents single. No, the thought makes reason stare. Truth is reason, truth eternal. Tells me I've a mother there. Brigham Young, when questioned regarding the hymn, said it was a true principle. I can understand Eliza R. Snow's longing for the feminine attributes of God when considering the male-dominated society that she lived in. I want to see the wholeness, the completeness of God, too. Mother in heaven. One Restoration Church teaches that the terms father and mother are titles, even priesthood titles, and not gender-specific. It is because father is a title that Jesus Christ is referred to as such in the Book of Mormon. The Pearl of Great Price, chapter 3, 5, verse 5 of the Book of Moses, teaches that everything was created spiritually before it was created on the earth. If gender is eternal, there is still an intersex, a third gender, to include in the plan of exaltation. Or do intersex children of God get to choose their gender in the resurrection? Or, let's see, if so, then gender isn't eternal. If it takes a male and a female, as we understand it, to create spirits, the scriptures still clearly leave room for gay and lesbian couples to be part of the celestial kingdom and celestial families. What is greater than of sons and of daughters, as in Isaiah 56? Spiritual procreation or something else? The scriptures can support the active participation of gay and lesbian couples using the creative power of the priesthood to create worlds, maybe just not populate them, but perhaps on closer evaluation or examination. How much do we accept without questioning because of the traditions that have been handed down over the generations? How much do we really know? How much do we project from our present situation onto the past and into the future of existence? The restoration of all things. Doctrine and Covenants 71 reads, Wherefore labor ye in my kingdom, call upon the inhabitants of the earth, and bear record and prepare the way for the commandments and the revelations which are to come. The teachings we have been handed down regarding GLBT peoples are false and cannot be supported by scripture nor by science. The Improvement Era, dated April 1930, had an article by Susie Young Gates. She wrote, True science and true religion are twin sisters, and the separation of each from the other is sure to be the death of both. Science prospers exactly in proportion as it is religious, and religion flourishes in exact proportion to the scientific depth and firmness of its bases. The antagonism of science is not to religion, but to the heathen survivals and bad philosophy under which religion herself is often well-nigh crushed. In the church we learn line upon line and precept upon precept. Even prophets whom we regard as neither infallible or omniscient feel the influence of cultural contexts. The Mormon Church does not lose credibility by acknowledging that we are even now in the process of seeking a more and nearly perfect perception of the meaning and application of divine love. Remember, two-thirds of the Book of Mormon is still sealed. GLBT people are not the enemy of God nor the church. We are, however, the enemy of ignorance, sexism, and the judgmental traditions of past generations. In 1832, Joseph Smith announced a revelation that included the covenant between men to be your friend forever and ever. Later, in 1843, Joseph preached that two who were very friends indeed should lie down upon the same bed at night, walked in each other's arms, embraced, talking of their love, and should awake in the morning together. Beginning in January 1846, Brigham Young began the law of adoption ceremony, sealing men to men, in the Nauvoo Temple. Because the sealing of men to men was the last ordinance Brigham Young introduced to the Nauvoo Temple, some have interpreted it as higher in importance than the sealing of women to men and higher than the second anointing of husband and wife. I doubt that it's higher, but probably equal. Wilford Woodruff was the prophet who discontinued these sealings in 1894 by saying that more revelation was needed before continuing its practice. Scripture is given to a specific audience, and as the historical and scriptures show, policies and commandments change, and they are adjusted to meet the needs and social, intellectual, spiritual understandings of differing times, places, and peoples. In Genesis, God is recorded as saying, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helpmate." Lifelong celibacy has rarely been a viable option for anyone, gay or straight. We can clearly see from a close examination of all of God's children that helpmate cannot always be the opposite sex. For those who are heterosexual and capable of creating children, the commandment in Genesis is applicable. The covenant and sealing power of eternal marriage extends the relationship forever. For those who are heterosexual and not able to bear children, adoption has been organized and the temple ordinance of sealing an adopted child to parents, temple adoption, has been instituted, even though sterile heterosexuals cannot physically keep the commandment to multiply and replenish the earth, and therefore their sexual acts are no different than those of gay and lesbian couples in this life. There is evidence of same-sex couples being part of God's chosen people in the Old Testament and as members of Christ's church in the New. Same-sex marriages were performed in the early church, and there is the possibility of same-sex sealings in the latter-day church. The values of marriage, modesty, and faithfulness, which are central to tradition, need to be applied in ways that shape choice and lifestyles for gay and lesbian people. The need to strengthen all family relationships seems crucial. Every family with beloved lesbian and gay members should spend as much time and energy as necessary to ensure that their families stand together. To value families means to value lesbian, gay brothers and sisters, sons, daughters as equal. Though there is no evidence that the same-sex sealings involve sex, it opened up the possibility for some individuals. But regardless of what the actual relationships were, this ordinance could and should be used to seal gay and lesbian couples in latter-day temples. The institution of same-sex marriage and temple sealing can and must become a part of the church in order to continue the process of perfecting the saints. And I know it's a long shot, but I think I will end with that.
Thank you, both of you. Now we'll go ahead and take some questions from people that would like to ask them. Again, I'm going to take a microphone around, and say we need to have all the questions asked on the microphone so that they'll be recorded for the session.
Now, not all at
any
once.
Any questions?
Please.
You guys did too thorough of a job on your papers.
I think I can talk loud enough to where I'll pick it up. John Charles, I'm really curious. You were mentioning that Official Declaration 1 and 2 were kind of socially put on the church under great duress. I agree with you wholeheartedly on that 1, but I have yet to find any information concerning Declaration 2, which was done in 1978, was not a time period for the church in great duress. The area that you mentioned was in the late 60s, early 70s. Basically, things had calmed down, and according to the study I've done, the reason that the revelation was given was President Kimball was very concerned about blacks donating to the temple down in Brazil, knowing that they would not be able to go through it. And so basically what we have was a head of the church that was trying to figure out how to resolve this situation and then a revelation coming. So I think we have an example of revelation actually coming both ways, either pressure or through concern, member of the church, of a compassionate head of the church, which I in turn think there, even though I admit it's a long shot, it could open up possibilities of further knowledge coming just because of education instead of social pressure. Any comments on that?
Yeah, quite a few actually. number one, first of all, I don't want to give the impression that I'm saying that social pressure is what causes the church to change its position, as if the revelation is some kind of a crass PR move or a sort of as the revelation is self-consciously invented in order to, make some change, because that's not the way it happens. I mean, the brethren prayerfully seek a course of action and act as they are, as they feel inspired. What I'm saying, though, is that, so first of all, the first thing I want to clarify is that I'm saying that historically, new revelation has come when social pressure has caused the brethren to reach a place where they begin to feel the need to seek for that new revelation. Actually, I think you're right. I mean, there is an important distinction between Official Declaration 1 and 2 in that Official Declaration 2 did not come about until after the period of intensest opposition had actually passed. I think you're right on that point, which I think creates an interesting precedent for the possibility of an Official Declaration 3, which is that it suggests that if the church ever got to a point where an Official Declaration 3 on the subject was to be revealed, it would not come until quite a while after the church had been facing intense opposition because of its stance towards gays, and then the opposition had died out. And so, which makes the time frame in which to wait for revelation even longer.
In my opinion, the church was under tremendous pressure at the time the revelation came. If you read Leonard Arrington's book that just came out on the subject, you'll see a passage there that the church was threatened by the removal of tax exemption by the state of Wisconsin. This created tremendous fear in the eyes of the church, and it wasn't very long after that that the revelation came.
I don't know if everyone here is familiar with the Brown Proposal, 1969. To me, what that says is the pressure had mounted. Molotov cocktails were being thrown on the floor of the BYU basketball games. They locked up the Temple Square area for the first time in its history because of a threat that there was they were going to be bombed. But primarily, Stanford was going to withdraw their athletic teams from participating with BYU. In that period from 63-4 up to 69, there was a great deal of pressure. At that time, Hugh B. Brown, who was assistant to David O. McKay, who was very ill, took it upon himself to say, enough is enough. He had supported changing that restriction for a long, long time prior to this. He took the reins. He got the votes. All other 11 members of the Council of 12 and his nephew voted, Tanner, voted. He had the vote in the pocket. There was no lightning bolt. There was no revelation. It was an expedient, practical solution to rescind an unfair policy. The only reason it didn't take place in 1969 was because Harold B. Lee was out of town, came back, overrode the brethren, brought Hugh B. Brown to tears, and postponed the inevitable for another 9 years.
I want to emphasize something, though, or re-emphasize something that I said in my paper, which is that there's an important difference between the situation surrounding Official Declaration 2 and the situation of gays and lesbians in the church, which is that in the case of Official Declaration 2, changing of attitude really was kind of the crux of the matter, because it wasn't as if there was a passage in the Doctrine and Covenants that said, blacks shall not be given the priesthood. The problem with the gays and lesbians face is the fact that DNC 132 does say a man shall marry a wife and that marriage shall be sealed and then they'll be gods, and that's the only way to become a god. And that creates a very different situation for us. I'm sorry, what was that, Jay? Yeah, but the emphasis there is on interpreted. I mean, you had to create interpretation around the passages in the Book of Abraham, which you don't have to do in the case of DNC 132.
Yeah. And that's what Dwayne is saying, is the interpretation
could be I'm not sure how you do that in the case of DNC 132, though, because that's pretty straightforward. I don't see how you can sort of interpret your way out of that one.
Probably this question is more for Dwayne. Can you tell us a little bit more about this same-sex ceilings, the context of all this thing?
There's a little bit of reading that is found in Mike Quinn's book, and same-sex dynamics in 19th century America. The law of adoption basically, from what we can gather, was to connect people through the priesthood in sort of a father-son relationship, although there is evidence of one or two that may have been a little different than that. Tony Felice talks about the one couple in his book, Out of the Bishop's Closet. Mike Quinn did not find some supporting evidence for that. However, I did meet someone who's from England who grew up as a member of the church in the town where the one died, and he said that it was generally accepted by the church there, the membership of the church, that they had been a couple. But I don't know how that can be. I don't know if we have an actual sealing ceremony record for them. I haven't had a chance to look for that, and Mike Quinn, unfortunately, has been out of the country almost since I started researching my paper. And so part of what my paper was about, maybe I'll just interject one thought, was to try and bring a lot of the dialogue that's been going, but very compartmentalized over the years. And I've never seen anything about the scriptures printed in any official or fringe official church publication like Sunstone or Dialogue in relation to the scriptures. Now, as John Charles mentioned in his paper, well, anytime Old and New Testament looks different than current LDS scripture, they just sort of dismiss it under, you know, incorrect translation or whatever. That works sometimes, but can't always, and I think there are ways of arguing out of a lot of that. Part of what got me going on this idea, which has been developing over the past couple of years, is some of the reading that I've done in gay, lesbian, spiritual, some of the books that have been coming out talking about gay and lesbian spirituality. This is from the Reverend Chris Glosser, whose companion's a gay Mormon. And he said, in accepting an award on behalf of the Los Angeles Times from a gay Christian group, the paper's representative charged those gathered at the award banquet to address as clearly and forcefully as possible the biblical issues raised by fundamentalists. This would give the media a better chance to present a balanced view as well as take the heat off of them for doing so. This could be our unique political, this is my writing now, our unique political calling as lesbian and gay Christians, Mormons, people of faith. By supplying the media and our elected representatives with sound biblical scholarship and theological reasoning, we can diffuse the arguments of those who would legislate anti-gay morality in the name of Christ. It's my belief that true truth, including biblical, spiritual, scientific, and political, are on our side. That includes in Mormon theology. I believe it's our responsibility and calling to raise to the challenge and educate our families, friends, and neighbors, and our religious and political leaders. If we work together wisely, either as pew sitters or theologians, politicians or political volunteers, demonstrators or letter writers, we can eventually persuade and succeed. And that's where I'm coming from.
And I'm going to plug in something here. Again, notice that the rhetoric of that passage is invoking this notion of education, this idea that the crux of the matter is attitudes, changing people's attitudes, and that we can do that as we educate and bear witness of our lives and so on, you know, and change their attitudes towards, you know, scriptural interpretation. And I have no doubt that that kind of project will produce definitely political change in this country, and it will certainly produce change in other religious denominations, and it will change, it will produce change in the attitudes that individual Latter-day Saints have towards, you know, the gay agenda or towards gay family members. But I think we also need to be realistic about the fact that that kind of education strategy is ultimately not going to win gay and lesbian people full fellowship in the church, because ultimately education is not the problem. Ultimately the problem is that there's a passage in D&C 132 that links exaltation to heterosexual marriage, and that becomes a doctrinal problem. Even if the brethren wanted to bring gays and lesbians into full fellowship, they couldn't, because as long as that passage stands as scripture.
I think I might go on with that. That's where I think it's important to really get out there and talk about the extent of the human experience. And there are questions that are, you know, have arisen that I tried to bring out in my paper that need to be looked at and dealt with from a theological point of view. And I don't think that it requires a complete shift in theology, but just adding on a couple of pieces to what's already there. So,
I think if the church were just dealing with lesbians, they wouldn't be putting money into California. Because women don't mean that much in the church. It would be totally overlooked, and they'd smile and say, well, those silly ladies. The issue is that it's men, one kind of man against another kind of man. And they will use that scripture, that 132 thing. It's insurmountable. You can have little add-ons and caveats for women, maybe, but not for the boys, no matter what kind of boys. It's a boy church about boys, about men. It's male. And as long as you guys are boys and men and male, it's a lost cause. Because it's about one kind of man against another kind of man. And the kind of men you guys are against are the guys with the money and the power.
But we have fashion.
You have what?
I said we have fashion and style.
You say that 132 isn't going to be changed. There's another presentation here that talked about polygamy, and there's a tremendous pressure of the church to deny that polygamy was a real in revelation to Joseph Smith. And there's a possibility that it is going to be changed, and that will have to be altered. And there's no reason if it's altered once, it can't be altered twice. Another reason, another thing is you assume that the passage that we are created in God's image assumes that it is man or woman. Well, he said in God's image, and we assume that God is man, and so all women are not going to be included. Or if you say that the gays can't be included because they're neither man nor woman, there are other handicapped people that won't be included because they wouldn't be created in God's image either. If they're missing anything at all, then they wouldn't be in God's image. So I question your thinking on this one thing.
Well, I'll let Duane respond to the image of God issue, since that's, I think, really more directed towards his paper. In regards to the polygamy thing, there's a false analogy that people make. They say they like to compare. Well, they like to say that it's really ironic that the church would oppose homosexuality, which is, of course, a non-traditional family dynamic, when they used to embrace the non-traditional family dynamic of polygamy. But that overlooks an important distinction between polygamy and homosexuality, which is that polygamy is heterosexual and homosexuality is not. And that's really where you get into problems, because polygamy can fit into the dynamic described in DNC 132 because it's still a man taking on a wife. It's a man taking on several wives, but it's still a man taking on a wife. The problem with homosexuality is that you then raise the specter of a man taking on a husband or a woman taking on a wife, and that DNC 132 doesn't allow for it. Do you miss anything about the image of God?
Well, I don't have any revelation on it, just a sense that we've been going on tradition, and at least the readings that I've done that include other traditions, people tend to see, and I believe in God, but people tend to see what they're culturally prepared to see. And it seems that God leads people through that to higher spiritual understanding and community. And so I think we've got a few things that can help us in the learning process in helping the church realize that they need to expand their interpretation. I don't know. Hopefully other people are thinking on this, and let's work together on how we can help expand the ideas.
I want to throw in there that I think the intersex issue, as you use the term Duane is using to refer to it, may be one door that cannot be completely closed and wasn't really addressed by what John Charles had to say. And so that's something that may be the crack in the armor that they may not be able to get through. Okay.
Yes, I was just going to say, to your point about men in peculiar people, there's a therapist who says that giving power to homosexuals feels like giving power to women, and conservative men cannot bear it.
Yeah, I tried not to bring up the topic of priesthood, but in several passages I included priesthood on lesbian couples, if you notice that. And I understand very well, in addition to the whole concept of intersex, that priesthood, and I believe it's supported by Mormon tradition, actually, in regards to Nauvoo, and the whole concept that women, it talks about in the Pearl of Great Price and in the temple, of women having the priesthood, of priestesses and goddesses and all of that. And so the doctrine's all there. It's just learning a new interpretation of what the doctrine actually means. And I believe that intersex can help in expanding the priesthood to all of God's children. But it's going to take, you know, several thousand years of patriarchy, of getting over patriarchy, for that to take place. I'm not going to hold my breath. And, you know, I tell people my relationships with God, it's with no religious denomination, but wherever there are people looking for truth, you know, I'm there with them.
I just like to make a comment. I enjoyed both of your papers very much, and the information in both of them is intriguing and interesting, and doesn't make a bit of difference in my mind about anything for me. And who I am is someone who was raised in an extraordinarily Mormon family, and I say extraordinarily because my father was a professor for 30 years at BYU in the religion department. And I grew up as the son of somebody. I also grew up gay, and I'm Mormon culturally. But this is probably the most Mormons I've been in a room with in many, many years. And I'm really glad of it. And I'll tell you why. I came here for a friend, and as I listened to you speak, I really thought that it was nice, but I thought, that's a lot of energy. It ain't going anywhere for me. And I'm not putting you down for that. I'm saying that at some point in my life, I had to let go of this church. And I had to give all of my energy to God. Because the church hasn't done a damn thing for me. And I don't believe there's a chink in anybody's armor in this church. I agree with this woman. They got the money. And they've all got penises, and they've got well-heeled lawyers, and they will do whatever they want. And their threat, I agree, is from the male homosexual and not from the lesbian. Because I know what it was like to be homophobic, because I was as a kid. I was raised to be homophobic. That's what I was raised to be in this church. That's what I was taught to be. And self-hate just came along with it when I started to realize who I was. And the reason I make these comments is because I think it's interesting that we talk a lot and we publish books in the church and we say this and we say that. In the long run for me, you know what finally worked? Bye. Leave. And then come back and come to my family and say, this is what I believe. I love you. It will not change. I am a cultural Mormon. I am not interested in offending you. And it was amazing what happened. They've turned around and accepted me and taught me more about Christianity than anybody in this world. Going to my workplace and saying, yeah, I am culturally Mormon. I do have a lot of beliefs in the Mormon church. And I'm gay. And having them accept me. And I work in a traditionally very homophobic society and workplace. And I say all that simply because, not that I put anybody down for doing it, but I'm just saying that for me, when I was finally able to let go of the fight, I started to grow spiritually more. And if anybody in this room is struggling with that fight, sometimes it's okay to let go of it. Sometimes it's okay not to be an activist. And sometimes the best activism occurs within ourselves when we can finally say, this isn't what's important to me. Finding chinks in people's armor isn't important to me. Finding out whether the Bible can be interpreted 75,000 different ways really don't matter to me anymore. I know who I am. I know who I love. And who I love first is God. Second, myself. And it works. the church isn't going to get any energy from me. None. I am not going to give them any power to piss me off. I'm not going to give them any power to change who I am or change how I feel. And it works for me. Just an editorial comment.
I feel like I'm in sort of a weird place to respond to that comment, because my paper tends to lend itself to that conclusion that, you know, it's not going to change, so, well, you know, what do you do in response? Well, you leave. And one thing I like about the kind of thing that Duane is doing, even though I'm skeptical about the credibility of a lot of the scholarship that he cites, is that it does give people who are within Mormonism a way of conceiving a positive self-identity in terms of Mormonism. And that's why I want to make the distinction that, well, I think, you know, DNC 132 prevents the church from bringing gays and lesbians into full fellowship. The kinds of things that Duane is talking about, even though they won't change the church's policies, do give people who are within Mormonism a way of conceiving positive self-identity within Mormonism.
Is there a question?
Yes. For those who do hope to find their place within the church, I'm wondering if either of you or anyone in the audience is aware of positive steps, maybe baby steps, that they see in the institutional church. I'm aware of a couple. One is that they're not doing aversion therapy at BYU anymore. Another one is they're not counseling homosexuals to marry and get over it. Are there other positive things that you
see?
Well,
that's officially, but there are still bishops and stake presidents who do tell their men and women to get married. And yes, they're not officially, from what I understand, conducting aversion therapy at BYU, but LDS Church Social Services, as well as a number of the clinics in the state, still are through a network of church social people. And so there's still drug therapy, hypnotic therapy going on. Because I consider myself an activist, call it incarcerating teenagers when they come out and putting them in clinics.
Nothing very hopeful?
There is hope. And what President Hinckley said a year ago in October conference I thought was very nice. It basically was an echo with Mormon terminology of the Catholic American pastoral letter on homosexuality. You know, families must love their children through Christ, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's still love the sinner, hate the sin. And that's a lie. People think they can do it, but
I was just going to suggest something to add to your bibliography here. Bestseller, The Good Book, has a fine chapter on how the Bible can be misused, in his view, to condemn homosexuality in ways he doesn't think are supportable.
Thank you. I want to throw in something here, too. Despite John Charles's statement about education not being the key to getting, not being sufficient to bring gays and lesbians into full fellowship and as church members. There's also, he does believe education is very important. I mentioned in his introduction about two different booklets he has written. The first one, Understanding and Helping Those Who Feel Homosexual Attraction, Suggestions for LDS Family and Friends, is modeled after the suggestions for ecclesiastical leaders that the church published in 1992. And it goes through and basically gives information to people that are dealing with family members and friends that are homosexual. And, of course, it's helpful to the homosexual people themselves. But based on church sources, including the church booklet, to give them information about how to deal with the issue and what things they need to look at. And the new booklet also will be useful once that's published.
I'm so old that I go back an awfully long time when it was mother's fault. But also I am a granddaughter of the 13th apostle, Susie Young Gates. And I know that she had troubles, and she would ask her father if she could do this and that. And oftentimes he said, as long as you're taking care of your children and your gospel. And she'd go to England and represent the women, not of the church, but of the United States and things. So there are changes that are coming about. I have to say this. And Dwayne, I went to a PFLAG meeting in California quite a while ago. And they told me that when you need to do something about this thing, especially in Washington, for every gay or lesbian that writes to them, it counts one. For every mother that writes to them, it counts 10. They didn't know I was from Utah, but they said, for every Utah mother that writes, it'll count 100. Get your mothers to write. No, I think that it's gonna change. It has to. I don't know how long it's gonna take, but scientifically, it's got to change. And then I want you to think of somebody else that's gonna be hit. Think of all those women down at the BYU that are social workers that have been taught to help people change. They're going to feel so, and men are in social work too, they're going to feel so damn guilty. And is the church going to help them with their guilt? I don't think so.
I just wanted to comment in regards to, where's that brother that commented? I guess he left. Oh, Brent? Okay. Basically, where I come from is I love people. You know, Mormon, non-Mormon, gay, straight, bisexual, transgendered. I guess one of the things that keeps me associated with the church is the people. I can understand your, and I really relate to your conclusion that you needed to leave the church to have a stronger relationship with God. And, you know, I don't know where my future is going to go if that's the route the Lord wants me to go someday. I may have to do that. But meanwhile, I feel